Hello and welcome to Post Game, SideQuest's Patreon podcast all about our hot takes on cold games, by which we mean that we don't play games when they come out. That would be a ridiculous thing to do.
Outrageous.
I'm Melissa. I'm SideQuest editor-in-chief. My pronouns are she, her.
I'm Nassim. I'm SideQuest's managing editor. My pronouns are they, them.
I'm Zora. I'm SideQuest's copy ogre and assistant editor, and my pronouns are they, them.
And today we're going to be talking about game mechanics, which sounds like the world's broadest topic, but we're going to be talking about the way that mechanics of the games that we have been playing lately inform how we experience play. And this was a difficult topic to come up with because all I have played recently are games about politics. And I don't just mean like in the sense that everything is about politics. I mean, literally all I've played is games explicitly about politics. Not every game is as explicit about its politics as the ones that I've played recently.
Every game is political. Some games are about socialism.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I played A Bewitching Revolution, which is a really cool and I say cute. I don't know if everybody would use the word cute for it because I think that almost feels like I'm like diminishing it somehow. But I mean that in the best way. I mean, it looks cute. And I like the way it makes me feel. So I'm going with cute. In this game, you play a witch, go figure, in sort of this very, you know, corporate, unfriendly society that's all about work and productivity and credit and all of these different kinds of things. And as
that
a witch...
sounds like our society, you see.
It's definitely inspired by reality.
I have a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
I just Googled it and I found an image that says very loudly, heresy press.
Yes.
That's the question.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Heresy press. You kind of unlock as you progress through the game. So you help people using magic. And one of the first things that I did in the game was you help an unhoused person find a home. And what they do is they start heresy press.
Good. Sorry. That's very cute. That's awesome. And appropriate.
Yeah. So in this game, you kind of go around helping all of these different people with their various needs. You can, for example, transform a fast food restaurant into a community kitchen. You help unhoused people find homes, you plant trees, and you do this all with this very productive is a weird way to put it, but it's like this form of magic that doesn't like attack things or because, you know, a lot of times in games, magic is like you shoot a fireball at somebody and they die.
Yeah.
This feels like a very different take on magic. And I loved it. So you'll run into people throughout the game and then you can read their tarot cards. And reading their tarot cards is actually just like essentially giving them a brief lesson in socialism. So it's like you meet somebody and then you read their tarot cards and it's like, here is a little brief, you know, 4-card spread about the power of workers. And you do that. You do that a few times throughout the game. And the way it's written, it's written with earnestness and seriousness. It's not like tongue in cheek. It's not mocking in any way. It like legitimately felt good to see and hear these things. But one of the things I liked most about it was that the magic in it, because, you know, as I said, like a lot of times magic is like cast fireball, hurt someone.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the feeling of magic that you do, my favorite one is when you help the, because there's a variety of spells. You can like change the advertising messaging to be different. But my favorite one is when you help the unhoused person find a home, which is you have to be able to open locked doors. And to do this, it's very simple mechanically, right? Like you face a door, you click on the door. I think you right click on the door. In fact, big difference there. You right click on the door to cast the spell. And then you have to turn your back to the door and you walk backwards through the door. And then suddenly the door no longer exists. And like mechanically, that's super, super simple, right? But that is a different kind of magic than like we ever see in video games. It's not about force. And it just felt like, I'm like, oh yeah, this feels like what I imagine magic would feel like. The idea that I have to turn my back to something and almost trust that it will be there for, or it will not rather not be there for me. So that feeling of just like walking backwards to that door and having that door no longer be there was like this feeling of joy that I don't ever think I've had from casting a spell in a video game.
That's actually really interesting to me because I think what it explicitly also does is it takes away the quote unquote joy or like the, you know, the brain tickling that comes from seeing your magic work in other games. So like what you want in a different game is you want to shoot your fireball and see it hit someone and be like, hey, nailed it. Or you want to cast unlock door and see the handle move, right? Mm-hmm. But what this does is there's no visual component. It's just, you can't get through and then you turn around and then you can. And that's, I can see how that would be its own kind of joyful, but it's taking away the like kind of lizard brain immediate feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. And it like, I wanted there to be more doors for me to unlock so I could just keep doing that, because I was like, this feels incredible. And not only did the mechanic itself feel great to play, just because it relied on this sense of trust that video games are all about, not all about, but a lot of times are about that sense of visual pleasure that you mentioned, mm-hmm. right? Or some kind of like visual or narrative or some kind of like push button, receive dopamine kind of thing. Mm-hmm. In this case, it was trust and then receive dopamine. So that was, and like that kind of just ties into the themes of the game, right? Because you're going around helping all of these people and making these meaningful changes on this world through nothing really so much as like taking a moment to listen to their problem, telling them about socialism, and then making a tangible change in the world. And it's accomplished through magic, right? Like in this case, we're using a magic spell to unlock the door. But in, you know, in real world applications, it's like a reminder that a lock on a door is just a lock on a door. Mm-hmm. It's not an insurmountable force. These changes that are desired are not completely out of this realm impossible. These magic spells are simple, and so is like, I mean, it's not like simple to radically change the world. It's not as easy as it is in A Bewitching Revolution, for example. But it is like that version of the world is not inconceivable. Mm-hmm. And it's not unattainable. It's just, you know, it takes work to get there.
Something I think about a lot is how laws are actually just words on paper.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing that enforces them is human action. Like there's no force behind a law that's like tangible or physical. The force is in all of the people agreeing to obey and enforce the law via, you know, bureaucracy, which is, again, the actions of a lot of people choosing to do stuff, or in some cases, force. And this feels like a game that very much like acknowledges that. I say, having not played it.
No, I think that's true, especially because like the idea of something just being words on paper that is believed in is, you know, if you'll allow me to get metaphorical for a moment, is itself like magical, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
The form of magic that takes place in A Bewitching Revolution is a more literal form of magic in that I'm casting spells and making potions and stuff like that, but it serves the same function. This form of magic that you use in the game is not entirely different from an agreed upon ideology, which is exactly what you do throughout the game, you know, in converting the fast food restaurant to a community kitchen, in giving unhoused people homes and having them set up, you know, heresy press inside and spreading these ideas that there is an alternative. You know, it doesn't always have to be this very corporate, credit-based, capitalistic world. And I think the game does really, really well at that. It's very short. It's totally worth playing. I mean, I realize I mostly spoiled the entire thing, but I mean, you kind of know where it's going, right? But it feels good to play it. And I think it's one of those things where like sometimes I've been thinking about this a lot lately, especially because I've been reviewing the new Hellblazer series for mm-hmm. Women Write About Comics, which is, I'm so sorry. I can't stop myself from talking about Hellblazer.
Is this John Constantine?
Yeah.
Love, of course.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Hellblazer, you know. And Red Dead.
Mm-hmm. That's my jam. So this series is very much a return to the series' roots in the 80s, which were like explicitly political. Like you have a bunch of demons worshiping Margaret Thatcher. That's like what early Hellblazer is like. And this new series is kind of a return to that. But what I appreciate about it is that it says what it means, and then it allows you to feel something about that. And I think that there's value in that. And that's what I like about A Bewitching Revolution too, is like, yeah, it's like preaching to the choir, me. But at the same time, like sometimes it just feels good to have somebody say what you mean, what they mean, and then you can feel it together. And I think that's the itch that it really scratches for me. Also the super satisfying magic. On another note, another mechanical note, I played through Democratic Socialism Simulator, which is pretty cool. So Democratic Socialism Simulator kind of plays like Reigns. It has that like swipe left, swipe right feel to it, which I am 31, And I have been married to the same person for 7 years, and he's the only person I've ever dated. I don't know how Tinder works.
Don't ask me. I met my spouse on OkCupid, so that was before swiping things. Yeah, before swiping.
I don't know how swiping works.
I don't date, so I also don't know how swiping works.
There's like this assumed idea that I'll know that right means yes, left means no. I don't even know if that's true. There's an assumption that I'll know what that means, but I don't. So
wait, so when you say this game plays like Reigns, is Reigns, do you mean like the horse Reigns or
no? Oh, no, I mean the it's like a king or queen simulation game where you like swipe left or right to deter, like you'll be presented with a choice or whatever, and then you swipe one direction for yes, one direction for no, and then you use that to kind of balance your popularity with your constituent, well, your peasants, I guess.
It's a phone game, I think, right?
Yeah. It's really cool. I like Reigns a lot. But man, was there a learning curve as far as me trying to figure out what direction I was supposed to swipe.
Okay. I feel like maybe I've heard about this game, but I certainly have not played it, and we're doing great.
I liked Reigns 2 quite a lot. I didn't play, I'm just like, you know, full disclosure, like I'm more likely to play the game with a female protagonist than a male protagonist.
Same.
That's my life. I didn't like Reigns 1 as much, but I liked Reigns 2 quite a bit. Also, Reigns 2 had like a really cool subplot. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about Reigns 2. But Democratic Socialism Simulator is a little bit clearer because you have two choices on screen and it's swipe one direction or the other to, I think. No, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know what I'm talking about. Don't ever think that I know what I'm talking about, because I don't. But anyway, in Democratic Socialism Simulator, you are the newly elected president of the U.S. or an analog, whatever. You're in charge. And you have a bunch of different options to implement or not implement various democratic socialism or democratic socialist platforms, ideas, etc. And in doing this, you have like a visual representation of like maybe 20 or so voters who, the further away they are from you on the screen, the less they agree with you, the closer they are, the more they agree with you. Mm-hmm. Each individual voter has different concerns, like, you know, they care about what's going on elsewhere, they're worried about defense, they're worried about economics, all of these various, I mean, they're very distilled, but all of these various concerns that they have. And you have to gauge, you know, you have to keep an eye on your budget, your popularity, what control of Congress you have, and you also have to strive for re-election. So you're trying to balance all of these things while trying to, or not trying to, if you so choose, implement very specific democratic socialist goals.
This sounds very stressful.
Yeah, so it sounds stressful, but I actually feel like really good after I play it. And the reason for that is like, so my first game, I got assassinated.
I feel great, says Melissa.
So my first game, I was like, you know, everything I want, I'm going to go for. No concessions, none whatsoever. I don't care about, you know, having a cool suit. I don't care about having Secret Service, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So like I made it through one term as president. And then in my second term, because I was like, you know, screw anybody who doesn't agree with me. I have no interest in you. Also, I don't need a Secret Service. I got assassinated. But what was fulfilling to me about that particular run was the fact that I was super, super unpopular with some groups. Right. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of people were like, yeah, this is cool. I like this. Hmm. And even on subsequent playthroughs, so on a second run, I did the opposite of what I would do. And I was removed. Like, the people were like, get this asshole out. We hate them. So I was removed. And then in my third playthrough, I played a little more pragmatically. I made concessions on things like, will I wear a suit to my to my swearing in? What was another concession I made? I don't know. There was some other concessions I made as far as like, I guess, appearances and decorum, but I mostly stuck with the policy that I would like to enact, with some concessions for things like, this is going to send me into a free fall as far as budget is concerned, which will eventually lead to my removal. So it was more like, let's save that plan for later or something like that. And the result was that I served two successful terms and all of these wonderful policies were passed and the vast majority of people were happy. Obviously, this is like not a simulation of the real world, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing that struck me about it was the fact that even people of differing, like totally differing views. Like there are people who are like, I hate immigrants and I want to bomb every country in the world. That's not America. Even they benefited from the policies and therefore they weren't like violently opposed to me. Mm. And so it created this like feeling of there's obviously disagreement on a lot of really important issues, but the philosophy of having this government where its primary role is to like ensure the safety and security and health of its people is not actually something that all people are opposed to.
Right.
And that was reassuring even in the run where I got assassinated. So the sense of joy I got from that was that idea of like these policies can be appreciated by a variety of people. Obviously some people are always going to be unhappy. There's always those two assholes at the back of democratic socialism simulator who like get this person out. But in this policy-based approach, in this obviously biased game, right? Like it's not going to, it's coming from a place of bias. There was no feeling of like, this is a hopeless struggle. And I think that that's something that is very necessary because when you're working for societal change, it's very easy to feel like everything is hopeless and you can never find a point of agreement. And sometimes it's necessary to have that reminder of like, you might be surprised by how many people fundamentally, like, it's like the idea that like Medicare for all is like a widely popular idea. Mm-hmm. It's just that, you know, like the democratic establishment is not into it.
And at this point, the phrase Medicare for all has political weight,
right?
Even detached from the actual concept that it references, if that makes sense. So there's this idea in, there's this idea in rhetoric. there's the idea of the ideograph, or the ideograph spelled, it's pronounced ideograph, which is that it's essentially a fancy way to say that words have definitions, but they also have connotations. And those connotations differ based on the speaker and the perceiver. So the phrase Medicare for all has ideographic weight that is negative for the democratic establishment and for a lot of like conservative speakers, whereas it has positive ideographic weight for me.
right.
And a lot of people I talk to on my day to day. And so even so, that's why when we do these polls, we have to, that's why when people do polls about the concepts behind the terms, they have to phrase them differently. They have to describe the concept instead of just using the three-word phrase that we're used to referring it to with. That doesn't tie into Democratic Socialism Simulator. I just got excited about ideographs.
No, you know, I think it does, though, because like the fact that like we can find like widespread support for things like this when we talk specifically about the mechanics of the policy rather than the name that we call it, I think is exactly what's happening in Democratic Socialism Simulator. You're seeing like everybody benefits from a policy like Medicare for All called something that we can all, that we don't currently have like a mind frame for, right?
Yeah, it's just hard to give it a name that isn't the thing it is.
You can see how that policy, because like when I'm not sure about like Medicare for All specifically, but there are a lot of policies that are like democratic socialist on their face, right? But when you implement them in the game, everybody steps forward, everybody approves of them. And it's because they are, you know, beneficial for all. People aren't opposed to that. But they are opposed to, you know, potentially like the ideology or the big scary socialism word. And I think that's something that the game does really, really well.
That's really cool. That's exciting to me. I want to play it, but I also hate to play a game on my computer.
It did come in the bundle for racial justice. So if you got that, you have it.
Okay, so straight up, I did not get that because I hate to play a game on my computer. And also the list, the number of games in it was so big that I got scared and just went and donated to places directly. Yeah, I was like, I can't do this.
That's what I did too. I was just like, I will never play this many games. I can't do it. And I just backed out. It's like, nope.
There was a handful of games in there that I really wanted to play, like that I've wanted to play for a while. Yeah. And so I was just like, I might as well. Like, well,
now I regret not gonna play.
I'm not gonna play 99% of these games.
The thing that I regret is not getting an incredibly convenient list of games right. that I will enjoy. But I expect that there is a list somewhere.
There might be more bundles in the future. Like, I bought one that I'm hoping to play for next time. It's for Black Trans Liberation, and it's a lot mm-hmm. of like Ooh. Queer graphic novels.
Yeah, yeah, visual novels.
Yes. Oh my yeah, God, yeah, yeah, yeah. Visual novels. Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to playing some of those.
Yeah. The last game I played was Orwell, Ignorance is Strength, which I will lead with is not fun and is scary. So if you've never played an Orwell game, these are games where you sort of play like essentially, you know, how everybody's like, the FBA agent assigned to me, or sorry, FBI. What is the FBA?
The Food and Drug Association.
Yeah. The FBI agent assigned to me is having fun reading my text messages right now or whatever. So in this game, you play your FBI agent, essentially. And your job is to, you represent like the NSA of this authoritarian government. And you are trying to find, you know, people who are gonna blow something up or who are spreading propaganda, anti-government propaganda. You play the bad guy, basically. And you don't have, like, in the first game especially, you okay, gotta explain the mechanics first. So you go through, you compare things like news headlines, like private emails, phone calls, all this kind of stuff. Just full disclosure, I fucking love eavesdropping. I am suffering in my home for 6 months, unable to eavesdrop on a single conversation. So this really scratches that itch for me, because like, I fucking love eavesdropping. Anyway, so you're kind of snooping through all of this documentation, trying to find narratives and disclose them to your superiors. But what you find throughout the game is that you can craft a narrative depending on different pieces of information that you find, because sometimes there will be contradictions between what a person says and what they actually believe, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can feed the government, here is what they say versus here is what they believe, and you can change certain outcomes based on that. Which is fun. It's dark and upsetting, but it's fun. The second game, which is Ignorance is Strength, it didn't work as well for me, partially because I felt like it was too centered on this group of characters that I didn't care about as much. But it introduces what's called the influencer mechanic, which you're basically using at this point in the game to take down a rebel against the state. So he is like instigating all of this like anti-government hatred, and so your job is to use social media to influence public feeling about this guy. And you do that by exposing like various pieces of personal information to the public, and then starting a hashtag, and then using that hashtag to go after him. Unfortunately, I didn't beat the game because I got completely stuck and the walkthroughs were no help, so I don't know what happens. I did manage to make it through step one of the influencer campaign. But when I say that this is not fun and is scary, that's what I mean, is like, that's a very, like, we see that happen.
That feels too real. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was interested to see how it unfolds, but the way that social media, something that to a lot of people feels frivolous, and like, you know, the idea of calling it an influencer campaign, right, is like almost this form of distance, because we like, I say we in like the cultural sense, like we, you know, make fun of influencers or whatever, yeah. Like, oh, this this influencer snapping a photo of their food as if it's not important. But there's even the word influencer itself is a pretty powerful word, you know, like that's yeah. a person mm-hmm. who influences. And yes, and you know, a lot of times when we use it, we're referring to like clothes or art supplies or tea.
Okay, hold on. This has been bothering me since influencer like entered into the common like rhetoric. Did anyone else read a like YA sci-fi book where there were a set of characters called influencers? I swear to God, I remember
could
that.
Could it be Uglies by Scott Westerfield?
I don't think it was Uglies, but I think it was a Scott Westerfield book.
There was a side novel that might have been Specials.
Maybe it was that. Maybe it was Specials. Okay.
I don't remember Specials very well because I didn't like that one.
I read one where the main character was a boy and mm-hmm. he was emo, and
yes,
at
my people.
One point he had to bleach his hair and it sounded really unpleasant, and also there were characters called influencers and they were hot shit, And ever since, like, YouTubers or whatever have started being called influencers, I get flashbacks to that book and reading it in a car every single time it comes up. And I've honestly, because I can't remember the name of the book or anything, any other detail about it, it's started to make me feel like I made it up.
I can't verify for sure, but that does sound like an Uglies universe kind of thing.
Thank you for helping me feel sane.
I haven't read those books since like 2008, but that sounds Scott Westerfield to me.
Like, I didn't read. I read half of Uglies and hated it. Whatever.
Is Uglies this episode's Fargo?
No, no, it can't be. We can't do this. I just didn't like the structure. Like I got a couple pages into it, and I was like, there is going to be nothing in this book that I relate to, because I was in middle school and like a baby queer and not so aware of the word queer or words around it, but like becoming very aware that I didn't index into like kind of heteronormative ideas of beauty or self-image. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Uglies was very much about engaging with, so it's also the gender thing is, I can understand how Uglies would be really, really appealing to trans people, but for me as somebody who like fundamentally felt a disconnect with social and personal expectations of beauty and self-image, mm-hmm. Uglies just felt like it was going to trap me in a headspace that I had never wanted to be in.
I'm so glad I've never read this.
I bailed real hard.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I guess it is this episode's Fargo.
The whole influencer thing in Orwell like really struck me as I was playing it as very illustrative of the power that social media wields. And like, You see this in a variety of ways, right? Like the fact that I say we again in the cultural sense, we're always like retweeting shitty opinions to dunk on them, but in doing so we're furthering the engagement of that tweet, which boosts the platform and has a extremely counterproductive impact to what the dunker wants, supposedly. It also reminded me quite a bit of back in ye olden days of I want to say 2017 was when this happened. There was a big purge of Tumblr accounts, not the porn purge.
That happened too.
This is the Russian propaganda bot purge, which I say with air quotes because I know that there is some like disagreement about what exactly was purged in this instance. But the thing that struck me about Orwell, and that reminded me really strongly of this, was the fact that there was some pushback on the that Tumblr purge, because the argument was that like, no, they're just posting memes, therefore they can't be propaganda. But you know, the truth of the matter is like most things are propaganda to some extent. Like the alt-right famously uses, you know, memes and jokes as a means of kind of luring people into, you know, for example, like white supremacist spaces, and then that becomes your friend group, and then you don't want to leave, and then it's like, well, my ironic belief now has kind of become my real belief, so I guess I'm a white supremacist now or whatever. Yeah, you know, the cue the curb your enthusiasm theme. So the fact, like, I saw that response a lot in response to the bot purge was like, oh, well, these were just meme accounts, so they shouldn't have been purged. And it's like, well, like, maybe some of them were meme accounts, but like, even so, like, alt-right memes, leftist memes, all of them can be used to sow political division and, you know, sway people one way or the other. And it's not that like I'm not bringing some horseshoe theory bullshit here. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying here is that like everybody is susceptible to this kind of thing, right? Like it's not only the right uses propaganda, only the left uses propaganda. Propaganda is a useful tool.
Yeah.
And what this game does is it shows that like social media and like participating in something as supposedly innocuous as a hashtag or dunking on today's shitty celebrity or whatever, you know, the main character of Twitter issue, like participating in that kind of thing, like can also have political ramifications and connotations. And I think that's something the game illustrates very well. Was it fun? No, I got pissed off and quit because I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to do. But it was interesting. And I think it was very illustrative of this idea that it's hard to grasp, because it's like, oh, what does it matter if I dunk on today's Twitter main character? And it's like, well, maybe it doesn't, right? Maybe somebody just said something ridiculous and you want to dunk on them, whatever. But where did that attack originate? You know, where does it come from? What does it accomplish? what is it doing? I think those are valid questions to ask, even for something as innocuous as like, I put an old sock on my hot dog, look at it. And then everybody's like, look at this asshole with their hot dog sock. I don't know what the fuck is wrong with my brain. Trying to find a not real world, super innocuous example.
I mean, that's what I came up with. The problem is that anything is possible.
It's true. Look forward to hot dog sock coming soon from Twitter. It may be this totally innocuous thing of somebody doing that, you know, but also like, why did this get boosted? Who is benefiting from it? What are the ramifications? Where is it coming from? What is it doing? Those are important questions to ask, even on something as innocuous as hot dog sock Twitter user.
Yeah. You know? I mean, this has to do with, like, I'm going to go back to rhetoric. I studied sociolinguistics in college. No, but actually, I view the world through a lens of a lot of like rhetorical analysis, just because it suits my brain and because I have training in it. And one of the things that you learn in sociolinguistics is this idea of indexing and how you say something says just as much about your identity as what you say, as like the definitional meaning of the words. And this comes out in Twitter dunking specifically, is the things that you choose to dunk on and the way in which you choose to dunk on them say something about your position in a larger identity space. Mm-hmm. And then you can form correlations between those identities and political beliefs, and you can connect larger patterns of behavior with political belief, so on and so forth. It's why... I can't think of the example I was going to think of. So hold on.
Hot dog sock.
No, it's why I have a fundamental distrust of certain terms, and I can't think of the term that I'm trying to access right now, which is the problem. Ugh. Okay. Never mind.
Well, Medicare for All fits into this, right? Like, if somebody is distrusts that term, that probably says something about their political views.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a set of words a while ago that had to do with yet another word for like social justice warriors or activists or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I had a roommate who was like, he was like, so what do you think of this concept? And I was like, whoa, buddy, take a seat. Because he'd used the word that is most, the term that's like most commonly used in sort of online 8chan type spaces, right? Mm-hmm. And I had an instinctive like fight or flight reaction. And I know this guy, I know he's super not online, right? So I was like, okay, wait, no, we need to take like three steps back and talk about why you're using that term.
I think there's... Sorry, go ahead.
No, because I was like, it became a moment where I was like, okay, I have to think about the safety of not just myself, but also everybody I bring into this space if he's going to be here and using that term. And he's a sweet dude. He had heard it from his brother, who I now don't particularly trust. But you know, we talked it out and he was like, okay, I totally understand why you would want to avoid that term. And he also understood why him using it could cause somebody to feel unsafe. And this all relates back to Orwell, because this is exactly the kind of shit that the NSA also does, is they think a lot about patterns of behavior and how that data correlates with actual political ideology. Mm-hmm. And that's big scary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what makes Orwell interesting to play, is you get to play with those systems and see the potential ramifications of them. Whereas when you are just living in them, it is harder to, I think, see what they are doing on in a concrete sense. Because it's like, oh yeah, my FBI agent, blah, 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 blah. We've just accepted that as reality. But when you are the person who is actually manipulating the data, you see exactly how intense it is to think that somebody is looking through your text message records and crafting a narrative that could lead to your execution in the case of this game.
I mean, I start to draw the line at like, I don't think we actually have FBI agents watching us, but data on what we tweet and who we follow is there. It's out there.
Yeah.
And it does affect our experience online. It affects who we're suggested to, like, who Twitter suggests we follow. It affects ads that we see. I don't know that the government has access to that data. I hope to God that they don't. Mm-hmm. But people do. Billionaires do.
Yeah.
And that in itself is Orwellian. It's just a different ruling class.
I saw I can't even remember what it is now. I think it was a documentary, and somebody looked into their like dating profile stuff, and they went and they finally, like, after months, like, got the company to give them all the information they had on their dating profile, and it was an 800-page stack about
them.
That could be bought by anybody, and that's terrifying, right? I mean, it's like the trade-off of, like, we put information online about ourselves, often willingly, not always thinking about the ramifications. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, but then it's a trade-off of, like, how much information we want others to have, like, others who we know to have about us versus others that we don't know. It's scary.
Yep. I use dating profiles in Orwell.
Great. That,
cool. Awesome. Awesome.
Naseem, did you want to talk about Papers, Please?
Yeah, I just briefly, because I haven't played it, but I've watched my partner play it. And from what I understand, the game is like you are an immigration agent and you're at the border, like looking at people's papers and seeing whether or not they match up or whether they could be a potential like national security threat or whatever the fuck. And so you can choose, like, you know, if someone seems suspicious, you can like mark them as suspicious. But I think you also have a quota of like certain suspicious people, like, you know, how many suspicious people did you catch, and your family's in danger as well, from what I understand. So like if you don't hit that quota, you then like your family could starve or they could be arrested or something like that.
I think I'm not sure if it's true through the whole game. It's been quite a few years since I played it, but there is like you get, I think you get paid for the number of people that you deny.
Okay. Yeah.
Or something like that. There's a correlation with money as well. So like if you don't do a good enough job, they'll dock your pay, for example, and then your family starts to starve.
Okay.
And good enough job, of course, is defined by denying a certain number of people, not necessarily denying only the right people.
From what I understand, there's
a mixture. So like I think at some points there is a quota, and at some points like you'll just get like quote unquote corrected by the authorities as to like if for example I didn't notice that somebody was carrying a weapon and I let them through, they would notice and therefore they would dock my pay.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, while you were talking, I'm gonna say, like, while you were talking about the different games, I kept thinking about this because first I thought like, oh, wait, what was the cool one that you talked about? Okay, a Bilbuching Revolution is we were talking about the idea of like laws being on paper and then our, you know, people being the ones to enforce them. And I was thinking about this, right? Of like, okay, you as this, you know, like immigration agent or, you know, border agent have the choice of whether or not like, oh, this person may or may not be suspicious, but, you know, I am under certain obligations because of the law, but also because of my family to decide whether or not I'm going to let them through. And it's just like a terrifying, like, I thought it was really nice that a Bewitching Revolution took this in such a, like, a nice direction and a fuzzy feeling direction, such a scary direction, because it's not like it's not happening, right? Like, we are fully, especially in the United States, right? Like, fully aware of all the bad shit that ICE does. Mm-hmm. And thinking about, like, the way that, man, this is, I don't even know where this is going, but the way that we construct games and like how we decide to engage with these ideas can give us sort of new directions as to how to think about them. I guess, like, I had never thought like, oh, we can engage with this idea of like laws that can be both harm, you know, that more often than not, I think, can be harmful by creating a world in which they don't have, like, we don't have to follow these rules that we think that we're following, or the way that we expect a certain mechanic in our world, such as magic, to work doesn't have to be the way that we think it's going to work. And then you hear it in contrast with Orwell, right, where it's like, okay, we're taking ideas that we talk about quite commonly and may or may not actually be constructing narratives that people may or may not be actually constructing in our government, in our society right now. And I don't know where I'm going with this, but those are things I thought about.
I think that the contrast between specifically A Bewitching Revolution and Democratic Socialism Simulator with games like Papers, Please and Orwell are, I think that's a vitally important comparison. I have heard people talk glowingly about Papers, Please for years, and I've always been interested in it, but every time I look further into it, because I have the memory of a goldfish and forget what it is immediately, every time I look into it, I'm like, oh wow, this is like a political game about immigration and kind of the difficulties and choices therein. And every time I find out that you're playing the immigration officer, and your whole job is essentially to deny people entry. And every single time I find that out again, I feel this deep desperation.
Yeah.
Because I find that games typically are power fantasies. Mm-hmm. And that means that Papers, Please, for me, represents the power fantasy of having control over people's lives that way. And, you know, it's co-opting that co-opting is the wrong word. Co-somethinging. Co-subverting. it's subverting that power fantasy a little bit, because you know you're kind of in a lurch, your family is in danger, but the power fantasy comes when you succeed, when you've chosen the right people to say no, you can't come in. The game isn't about celebrating the people who you help, it's about celebrating your choice to deny the correct people.
Yeah.
And that's upsetting to me. I don't know. I don't want to say that like the game shouldn't be made, but I can't play it because that would be so deeply sad for me.
Yeah.
I think,
go ahead.
I think the language of games is such that you want to win, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in a game like Orwell or a game like Papers, Please, both of which are games that I enjoy and find very interesting. Enjoy is maybe not the right word, because fun is not a word I would use to describe either, but I find them interesting and compelling, but they are not fun, and they do not make me feel good to play.
Yeah
The language of games is such as that it would lead you to believe that that's the case, and if you go in with that mindset, then like, yeah, it could easily be a power fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's tricky because, you know, like I come from a family of immigrants, and my mother's family were refugees, and my husband comes from a family of immigrants as well, not refugees but immigrants, and his mom was undocumented for 10 years. And so it's funny when I think about like this like brown Hispanic man sitting down to play this game, which he finds interesting also and compelling, but not in a positive way compelling. Mm-hmm. Like the narrative idea of like, you know, someone who is from a background of immigrants or from a background of refugees, like sitting down to play a game like this, it's such a weird like cognitive dissonance of like, I don't want to be engaging in these structures that are still happening, right? Like I come from West Asia and a Muslim majority country where like this narrative in the United States is very much like, oh, my people are dangerous, right? Like we shouldn't be letting my people at the border. And I understand the kind of, I don't know if powerful is the right word I want, but the idea of like you as a player sitting down and actually experiencing those and having to make those decisions and contemplating them. But it makes me also like deeply uncomfortable in a way that I'm like, I don't really want to engage, but I'm glad someone else did so I can think about it and like talk about it without having experienced it.
Yeah,
firsthand.
I definitely don't feel like these games shouldn't exist. Right. But the psychic engagement that they require and the way that I engage with games means that it would be a deeply negative experience for me.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I think they reveal something interesting about the way we think about games and like not the environment in which they're created, but like kind of the cultural space they occupy. Mm-hmm. The idea of like winning itself is very fraught when it comes to something like Papers, Please. How many people did I deny entry to? How many people are going to starve because of, you know, my choices? Did I win? Like,
yeah.
It's fucked up. And I think the game itself is not making the point that you should like celebrate how many people you deny. But
yeah, that's what I understand.
Because of what games are, right? There's always the potential for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't know who's sitting behind that screen. I mean, I would imagine that somebody who follows, you know, who buys into those policies probably would not pick that game up, but you never know.
I mean, I like it, but it's boring as shit. So, like, you just looking at documents, that's...
Yeah.
Well, now you've heard about all the cool games that I played. It turns out when you come into a discussion with three games, it kind of dominates the conversation, but we will return in the future, hopefully with some thoughts about other games from other people.
I'll certainly have many thoughts about Blazeball forever, which we're going to talk about this time, but
I still don't know where that is. So
we'll talk more. I'll have like a season fresh in my mind and in my heart. I'll be able to talk about all our favorite characters who I don't want to name now because I'm very afraid that they'll be dead by the time this podcast comes out.
Josh and I have signed up to play, look at,
excellent,
enjoy,
participate in. We do a lot of talking about, my roommate and I at least do a lot of talking about the cultural event of Blazeball as opposed to the game
understand.
Of Blazeball. It's okay.
I don't either.
Okay.
I read a thing about it so I could try to figure out what it is, and I left knowing slightly more, but I signed up for it and I'm going to experience it.
The bizarre thing is that it really does feel like sports fans, except the vast majority of them, being the Blazeball fans, are like leftist nerds.
Yeah, sounds like many people.
And we can't tailgate because there's a million games a day.
It really interested me because last year my husband and I got very into Marble Olympics.
Yeah.
And like we were very passionate about our totally arbitrary teams. Like I chose the Green Ducks just because I like their name. Mm-hmm. I like ducks. That was my only reason. And then I rooted so hard for the Green Ducks. My husband chose the Hazers because he liked the color of the marble. And the Hazers did really well. And he was stoked about it.
I'm very proud.
And like marble... Mm. The Marble Olympics are just like arbitrary, and I'm into that.
The New York Millennials, almost, we almost, we were in the finals of season 3. It was taken from us cruelly by the winds of fate, but I felt pride for this fictional team of names that are only names and text and small like collections of stat data. I wanted them to win so bad. I stayed up late. I stayed up until like midnight.
Wow.
Which is late for me. I go to sleep at 10 like a baby.
I do too. So
I do too.
Excellent.
Just a bunch of babies on this podcast.
Excellent.
Yeah. Anyway, so tune in next time for Zora's Blazeball Feelings.
I love it. I love it. So thank you for joining us. Find us and all of our wonderful writers and articles and pieces of writing and poetry and whatever else at sidequest.zone. That's our hot takes on cold games. Thank you.
And good night.
And good night. Or good morning, or whenever you're listening to this. I don't know your life. Okay. Everybody's health checks passed. Everybody's got a line.
Great.
Yeah.
Excellent. We're good. Oh, my line is so little.
Okay. Hello. God, I hate I hate it. I hate saying the word hello because now everybody who has ever listened to Fake Geek Girls automatically, like in real life, says, "And welcome to Fake Geek Girls" afterwards.
Wow.
That's accurate. That is what I was thinking.
You can choose a different greeting. I don't know what it would be.
Salutations. that's not forced at all. Hello and welcome to Post Game. This makes no sense if you, like, anyway. I like the never, we never know what this episode's Fargo will be until we're already in it.
Excellent. And there's always going to be one.
There's always going to be one.
Maybe it won't always be Zora. I'm sure one of us will go off.
I mean, I did go, I only went off a little, but I did go off a little bit about Hellblazer.
That's true.
No, so. But you went off in a positive way.
Hellblazer is really good. Don't cancel it.
Yeah.
I know you're listening.
DC Comics.
DC Bigwigs. I know you're listening to me.
Warner Brothers Media.